Right, we'll call the House of Congress meeting to order. It's a quarter after 3, and President Representative Ruenberg, Finkelstein, Collins, and Donnelly, and the way you treat it's February 8th. And the first matter on the agenda today is House Bill 334, which we've got a committee substitute. It's been adopted by the committee. And before the committee, are there any one person testified in an angry sign of testifying on 334, Mike Snyder. Mr. Snyder, did you want to testify? Mr. Snyder, did you want to testify on House Bill 334?
Yes, I do.
Why don't you go ahead and proceed with 334?
Well, if the chair, members of the committee, I'd like to begin by saying that, we don't always agree on exactly what the value of these things. I much appreciate the chair's efforts and the efforts of the rest of the committee in dealing with some of these difficult issues. I have a draft that stated 2690 of 334, an act relating to malpractice insurance for certain persons who are in regulated occupation or profession, and I'm assuming that's the most recent draft.
Yeah, that's been adopted by the committee before the committee today for written amendments and for action.
Okay, thank you very much. I guess I'd just a couple of comments about this. First of all, I think that this legislation is a great improvement over no legislation at all in this area. My concern, as I've expressed in writing to the committee previously, is that this form of the bill still gives those of us who enjoy the benefits of practicing as professionals in this state the privilege of one free bite, if you will. Before this provision applies, a judgment must be entered against some professional regulated by Title VIII. Certainly, you know, an attorney, for instance, could engage in numerous acts of malpractice, none of which are reduced to judgment because that person is uninsured or assetless or assets are hard to find or secure. And there would be no, and this provision of law would not apply at all. I just don't think we ought to give one free bite. I think that we ought to be insured today for errors that we may make today or tomorrow, and that absent such a provision, the public is less protected than it should be. And those would be extend my comments on this particular bill.
Thank you very much, Representative Snyder. Mr. Snyder. Representative Donnelly's returning here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. Bills before the committee, chair would entertain a motion to move the bill with individual recommendations. Is there any objection to the motion to move the bill?
Jack?
Yeah, I object to it.
Okay.
I don't think we spent enough time on it, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. So let's have a vote.
I have a question for Mr. Snyder.
Okay. There's a question for you, Mr. Snyder. Anchorage, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. This is Representative Collins. In your testimony, you indicated that the concern that you had with the bill is that it still gave all professionals one free shot. And you used an example, perhaps an attorney who might commit a malpractice action and have a judgment entered against him would get another, that would kind of be a free bite. I didn't believe that attorneys were regulated under this statute. Are you suggesting that we include attorneys?
Okay.
I can't even say that we are, to be honest with you. The point that I'd like to make here is that whatever profession is intended to be dealt with by this malpractice insurance required provision, no matter who you're talking about here, this does not seem to apply until at least two things occur. First of all, someone has to do something wrong to one of their clients. Secondly, that error has to be reduced to judgment And even then, the protection required here will be for subsequent and future possible acts of malfeasance. It will not address the past act of malfeasance. You don't even have to pay off. You don't even have to pay off the judgment that's entered against you. You simply have to acquire insurance for future acts. And my own preference would be to make this law go farther and have all of us, whether covered by Title VIII or not, protect our clients from our errors and omissions. Now, does that address the question?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, attorneys are included in this legislation. Everybody who's not currently required to have malpractice insurance, who's licensed by the state, is covered by this bill. Representative Collins.
Another question I have, and I don't know who it would be for, but I know that, for example, the state of Alaska, when it does its RFPs for different things, will require malpractice insurance, that the respondees have malpractice insurance. And would it mean that if we pass this legislation, that perhaps that requirement could be removed from the? And why would that not be a duplication?
Well, it may be a duplication if they had previous malpractice judgment against them, but this wouldn't change the state's right to contract with people who have malpractice insurance.
So it wouldn't benefit people in that sense at all.
I don't understand what you mean by that.
Well, I guess my thought was that, you know, I could see some possibility of doing this if it simplified things, but it doesn't seem to simplify things. And I was thinking that as long as the department is going to be establishing a standard that's consistent for each profession, it would seem to me that the state wouldn't have to go through that extra step. Because if they do, then that means that whoever is establishing the minimum malpractice insurance requirements for each regulated occupation isn't doing a good job.
Well, that'll end the public testimony portion of House Bill 334. There's a motion before us to move the bill with individual recommendations. Further discussion? Representative Lee.
Mr. Chairman, one of the reasons I objected to that motion is that I think there's some tricky things in here that I don't feel comfortable yet about, and that's the timing. If judgment has been entered, I asked the question last time, and that's the initial judgment, not following somebody's working through the appeals process, and in some cases that's necessary. And I'm concerned about that, or either work through the appeals process or settle or agree not to go through that process. And I see it be down here, and until the judgment is satisfied or the parties have entered into a settlement agreement. And I'm just wondering we might consider modifying that standing before we move the bill.
Well, Representative Lehman, on Tuesday when we adopted the committee substitute, I asked any members to bring written amendments that they had proposed for today. I don't have any written amendments submitted. So if you've got something in writing, I'm entertaining it right now. Otherwise, I'd like to move the bill and get on with some of the business.
Okay, I don't have in writing today, but if the bill is moved and if it comes to the floor, then I will consider offering it on the floor.
Okay, the motion before the committee is to move the bill with individual recommendations. All those in favor of moving the bill? All those opposed? The motion carries. Representative Gruenberg?
Yeah, the question that Representative Lehman raised concerning what if this is on appeal, if a judgment has been entered and then there's an appeal going on. Obviously, there are ways to stay the judgment on appeal, and how that relates to this bill is an important question. And the reason I didn't say anything or speak up then, Mr. Chairman, is because this bill goes to the Judiciary Committee next, and I certainly would welcome you raising that question in front of my committee. And if you have any suggestions, I would urge you in that line to make them in front of the Judiciary Committee, because that's really more in that committee's jurisdiction. And I would invite you to do that. I didn't mean to think, I don't want the record to reflect that I felt that your comments were superfluous, because I don't.
Right, or you can take my concerns. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. Or you can take my comments with you to the Judiciary Committee, as I've expressed them here.
My suggestion would be, to be most effective, I would invite you to present your own issues before the committee. I don't want to put words into your mouth.
That was Representative Greenberg for the record.
Thank you, Mr.
The next matter on the agenda is House Bill 336. This is in the same situation as the previous bill. We adopted the committee substitute last Tuesday. We asked for any written amendments. I have no members of the public signed up to testify on this legislation. What's the will of the committee? That's the medical malpractice review panel.
Mr. Chairman? I'm wondering if Michael Snyder's still on the line, and if he has any.
He signed up to testify on House Bill 429.
Last bill we did?
Yeah.
That was 334.
The auto subrogation bill, he signed up to testify.
That's going to be a long one.
He just testified.
Right.
I'm just wondering if he had any comments on this bill.
Mr. Snyder? Are you there?
Chairman Donnelly, this is Deborah Gravel from the Alaska Action Trust. Mr. Snyder has momentarily left the room here. He should be back in a minute now.
That's all right.
Okay. Thank you, Deborah.
Welcome.
Well, like I said, I didn't have anybody sign up to testify on this. I hadn't received any written proposals for amendments.
Mr. Chairman, I have
Representative Pickleson.
I move that we move the bill with individual recommendations.
Okay. Any objection? Hearing no objection, bill moves with individual recommendations. Okay. Next matter on the agenda is House Bill 337. Once again, the committee adopted the committee substitute on Tuesday. Committee substitute. This deals with requiring that hospitals have liability insurance, malpractice insurance.
Yes, I'm wondering, is there anyone here from the hospital association, Mr. Chairman?
Nobody signed
up. Oh, Mr. Ryan Long is here. I wonder if I could ask a question.
Yeah, sure. Mr. Weinbaum, do you want to sign up for testifying on this?
Yes, I would just like to ask a question.
No, Mr. Chairman, I'll be glad to answer questions if you don't have any testimony.
Do you, are you familiar with the bill, Mr. Weinbaum?
Somewhat.
Okay, it requires insurance in an amount, not the committee substitute, in an amount not less than $500,000 for injury or death to one person resulting from one incident. $1 million for injury or death to two or more persons resulting from one incident. I have two comments, Mr. Chairman. Actually, the first is a question. That is, what is the customary insurance that the hospitals now carry?
Mr. Chairman, the short answer is I don't know. Let's get the information.
I'm just concerned, Mr. Chairman, whether, in fact, most hospitals carry significantly more than this, because this seems fairly low for a major operation like a hospital. Can you quote me any figures for any hospitals?
Mr. Chairman, I could, but I'm not sure they would be accurate. I'd rather Representative Grimmer get the information to you from the hospital. So there may be something from MICA, or maybe Ginger knows. I'm afraid that the information would be inaccurate.
I'm going to ask Mary Pierce if she knows. Okay, that's really good. Is Mary Pierce in Anchorage?
Representative Donnelly, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Did you hear Representative Gruenberg's question of what's the level of malpractice insurance that hospitals carry, those that do carry it?
Yes. Lowest level of any of the hospitals that we insure is $500,000 per occurrence, $1 million in the aggregate. That's an annual aggregate.
An annual aggregate.
Representative Grunberg.
Ms. Pierce, that's an annual aggregate?
Yes.
So this will then require additional insurance, because it says $1 million for injury or death to two or more persons resulting from one incident.
Representative Grunberg, that's my understanding. It would require additional insurance, because per incident, that would require $1 million per occurrence.
I understand, if I may, Mr. Chairman. Do most hospitals carry insurance in addition to your insurance?
I know of two hospitals that do carry insurance that we cover that carry insurance additional to ours. Bartlett, for instance, in Juneau carries excess insurance. They carry $1 million, $3 million limits, and they do carry excess insurance over and above that. I'm not sure of the amount and can't comment on that, but I do know that they carry it.
Do you know other insurance? Can you say that there are hospitals that are in the state that you know that do not carry other insurance, that are only insured through you?
Yes.
About how many would that be that you know of?
I'd say that there are approximately eight of the hospitals that do that have only our insurance and no excess insurance.
Do you have any information that would state that either, number one, you could not increase the limits to $1 million for injury or death to two or more persons, or number two, that hospitals would not be able to obtain the additional insurance?
There is an increase in premium for an increase in limits. We do make available both $1 million, $2 million limits, and $1 million, $3 million limits. So it is available. I think the question becomes, Representative Grunberg, a question of affordability.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, how much additional would it be to go to $1 million, $2 million, or $1 million, $3 million?
I think the increased limits factor is around 1.2%. I'm just saying that off the top of my head. So that would be the increased limits factor to go from whatever they were paying for $500,000, $1 million coverage to the $1 million, $2 million coverage.
So that would be somewhere around $12,000 a year?
Depending upon what they were paying for that. I don't have any rates with me, I'm sorry, but...
I see. Okay. I'm wondering if you can just give me any ballpark estimate of how much the increase would be for the hospital.
I would really prefer getting back to you on that, because the hospitals are rated on a per occupied bed rate, and I do have some information that I could fax to you this afternoon, but I would prefer doing that rather than trying to guess, because it's based upon the hospital's bed occupancy rate. So.
Yeah, this bill goes to Judiciary Committee next, Mr. Chairman. I'd appreciate it if Ms. Pierce and Mr. Reinwand could get me information as to the levels of insurance that the hospitals in the state have and the cost of additional insurance up to the levels you've described, Ms. Pierce. If you could just mail me that information, that would be fine. I don't need a fax.
Certainly can do that, Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Boyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Did we ever get anything from the Department of Health and Social Services as to a fiscal impact that this might have on the Medicaid facilities budget?
I asked for a fiscal note. I haven't received one.
So you asked for one since Tuesday night?
No. I'd like to see that. Mr. Chairman, I have one thing also. Thank you. I'm sorry. If I may, Mr. Chairman. And I'm sorry if I dropped the ball slightly on this bill, too. I was concerned and would like to offer an amendment at the appropriate time, or at least conceptually talk about it. Some of the hospitals are self-insured and don't maintain insurance or have some other method to post cash bond or something, I presume. to give the Department of Health and Social Services or the other appropriate agency some leeway in allowing this limit to be shown if they're self-insured or something like that. Because that was the testimony we got last time. I don't see any need for a hospital that is otherwise self-insured to have to go out and buy insurance, which frankly would help the insurance industry more than the public if they could pay the judgment anyway, and would like to see this bill conform to that. I don't know if you plan to hold this for a fiscal note from DHSS.
I don't plan to hold it, but I'd like to move it to your committee, Judiciary.
Okay. I can offer that amendment either here or wait till we get to Judiciary. You'd rather have me wait? Okay, that's fine.
Representative Boyd?
Also, just one kind of tangential issue to that issue, and that is whether or not you intend that all freestanding hospitals have to have separate policies, or whether or not Humana and Providence, for instance, which are self-insured through, can these or not in one case self-insured, but in other cases part of their larger organizational policies with other, their sister hospitals, whether or not that's clear. I'm not sure that it's very clear here in this, in the language, but if it's not, we can certainly address it at the Judiciary Committee as well.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, I totally agree. I think that this thing should be properly dealt with and drafted, and I don't know, I know you want to move the bill. We can do it there. I think the people around this table may have more expertise on that area than the other committee.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have an interest in the legislation, but also in making sure that it's right, but yet recognize that we want to move some of these things forward. So I will make a pledge to work with the Judiciary Committee to make sure that we've got the language that satisfies my interest in this, and we'll present it at the appropriate time.
Fine. If you would work with, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry. If you would have your staff work with Andy Hemingway, we'll do the coordinating. And if anybody else, anybody else has any concerns that we can help, we'll certainly do that.
Okay, Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Last Tuesday, we heard testimony that two hospitals are presently uninsured. Those are Petersburg and Cordova. And I might have missed it in testimony, but I guess I'd like to know how much money are we talking about to get this minimum insurance, and is that going to have a substantial impact on those two hospitals to either where they won't be able to operate or where it's going to, where it's going to really have a substantial impact on them? Have you heard any testimony that can answer that?
Let's ask Mary Pierce. Mary, are you still there online?
I'm back, Representative Donnelly. I really think that you probably should direct those questions to Petersburg and Cordova, because I don't know exactly the reasons that they chose to go uninsured, but they no longer have coverage with us. So I think that they, I would just not feel comfortable in answering those questions.
Representative Lehman.
Mr. Chairman, if I could direct this question to Ms. Pierce. Mary, do you know who owns those hospitals? Are those community-owned?
Yes, Representative Lehman, they are municipal-owned hospitals.
Representative Collins?
He asked me my question.
Oh. Okay. Then it looks like we'll... extra work, any necessary work could be done in Judiciary Committee. Okay. Well, then, didn't have anybody else signed up to testify on this legislation. Representative Collins.
I do have one more question. Mr. Reinwand, do you intend to come back, you know, to the committee with some comment from the people you represent in terms of the impacts this is going to have on those facilities?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we'd be glad to do that, Representative Collins. And we also understood, to be real honest, that this committee, and particularly the chairman, wanted to move these bills. And the whole issue of malpractice, liability, is probably going to be discussed at length in the Judiciary Committee. And last year's, you know, our focus was on 166. To be honest with you, the Executive Committee of the Health Association has not spent a lot of time looking at these bills because the prime focus has been 166, but we will be taking a look at them. And we appreciate the committee's and the chairman's interest in trying to address the issue. It may be coming from another direction that the committee would like, but we appreciate the efforts on it. But we just haven't had the time to look at these, to be honest with you.
Chairman, I'm motion to move the bills with individual recommendations.
Mr. Chairman, I have one other question that I might ask before, just before that motion, and that is, this bill requires it for hospitals, but are there other healthcare institutions that are not called hospitals that perhaps also ought to be covered under the same type of policy, either surgery centers or other things like that, that it may not be hospitals? I'm just wondering if that has been covered, or maybe we can address that.
Yeah, on Tuesday we had a discussion of the definition and set out those parts of the statute real specific that it's covered. Yeah, I'm not certain if what those kind of things fall under those particular components of the statute, but
Mr. Chairman, if I remember the discussion, it was that there's a lower threshold for, I mean, if it's publicly funded, everything gets included. You know, that's in that realm. And the certificate of need process will cut off at a certain level. And we have to get I can't remember from the statutes where it is, but it's a higher level if they don't let public fund it. And there are also those categories you're talking about. I don't believe they get certificates of need. Those emergency care centers.
What do you do if you want to prorate?
You want to prorate.
Threshold is made, though. Jerry, maybe you want to
volume.
I think that's right.
Lean back to the whole annual.
In any modification or changes, I'm not sure that there
regardless are of your activity level, that the, so that some of the minor care centers or the home fall into it.
Can't answer.
Representative Lehman?
I'd like to get the answer to that. If the, you know, either before we move it or after we move it, I think it would be appropriate that we at least determine who's impacted by this before we move it through the judiciary.
Okay. I anticipate we should be having a meeting of the task force. And Representative Lehman, you're on there, Representative Grimberg's on there, and I'm on there. And at some point in time, I know that the task force had all these bills before it, and we refined them a little more here, and the task force report that they end up in the Judiciary Committee with these bills. And maybe whenever the task force meets, by that time we can have some of this information collected too and be available to the Judiciary Committee to do what they need to do.
But the question, I think, Mr. Chairman, is appropriate to the Department of Health and Social Services. They ought to be able to tell us by facility anywhere in the state which facilities come under the provisions of the definition. I'm sure they can provide that fairly easily and quickly.
Okay. Well, motion to move individual recommendations. So move. Any objection? No objection. No. Motion carries. Bill, the House Bill 429, auto insurance subrogation. Mr. Frank, signed up to testify.
Perhaps it might be easier. I don't know if Mr. Garland or Mr. Kogan might not testify, but I know they have some recommended language. It might be easier for me to comment after they've testified on the language they're proposing.
No, why don't you go ahead, Mr.
Frank? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jay Frank. I'm here this afternoon on behalf of State Farm and Allstate Insurance Companies. The concerns that we had with the bill and the committee substitute on Tuesday, we still have. And I don't think we need to go into those in detail. I think the committee is aware that with respect to Section 1, we'd like to see some modification that allows an offset, but only to the extent that it relates to the subrogated amount of the insurer. with respect to the section 2, we again would like to see that there be some language in the bill that limits the excess policy to those vehicles that are made the subject of the excess insurance. With respect to section 5, that's the language that I believe the Division of Insurance had drafted. We've got a couple of concerns. The first is that the primary policy of motor vehicle coverage is not defined anywhere in the Act, and it's subject to some ambiguity as to what that policy might be. For example, does it mean that we can choose between any of the coverages listed in subsections 1, 2, and 3? It's just a little ambiguous, and we'd like to see that defined a little tighter. And finally, with respect to the concept that the division has adopted here, I've got to confess the actuaries back in both companies haven't had a chance to get back to me on that to determine whether that will alleviate our concerns about deleting the ISAC.
Any questions for Mr. Frank?
Yeah, once. Yes.
Representative Grimm.
Mr. Frank, you again wanted to have the vehicles listed. Why?
For underwriting purposes, Mr. Chairman, if I may, Representative Grimberg, the UM and UIM coverages in general are difficult to underwrite because we're insuring people who are unknown and we have no control over them. At least by designating the vehicles, there is some identification, and it provides at least a little bit of certainty for purposes of underwriting.
Any further questions for the witness? Okay. Further questions? Thanks for your testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Schneider, did you want to testify on 429 from Anchorage?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I would. Is you ready for me at this time?
Yeah, please proceed.
I guess before I go into my comments, let me address the idea of the importance from an underwriting standpoint of designating the vehicles. I don't pretend to be an actuary, and I don't know a great deal about underwriting, but I do know that uninsured motorist coverage traditionally has never related to specific vehicles. If you look at your uninsured motorist policy, you will see that you are protected when you are a pedestrian, and you will see that state law demands that coverage be to protect the people insured, not specific vehicles. So I guess that I'm not perfectly convinced that there is a salient and important underwriting criteria to be met here, and what we probably have is simply an attempt to limit exposure. Having looked at this, I understand that there's a very recent revision of Section 1. I have not seen it. I'm looking at a work draft that's dated 2-6 of 90, and my comments will be with reference to that draft. I think Section 1 is a good idea. I guess that my only problem with it is that I don't think it goes far enough. I think carriers should be told that if they try to write around the provisions of Section 1, that those efforts will not be tolerated. And I think that there should be some teeth placed in the law that would provide for private remedies in the event that carriers attempt to limit coverage or by other definitions in the policy attempt to avoid the implications of Section 1 of this Act, and I previously proposed language to that effect. Section 2 is clearly needed because Section 2 is currently in the law, and I think the additional language is a good idea. Section 3, I guess, as to Sections 3, 4, and 5, I'd like to make a couple of observations. All of these are proposed changes in 2820-445. 2824-45 was adopted, I think I'm correct in saying, by the 1984 legislature, and I think I'm also correct in saying that the change in the law was to take effect January 1 of 85. At the time that this legislation was adopted, there were some questions in the law related to uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage. There were questions in the law as to whether or not these coverages could be stacked and under what circumstances they could be stacked and whether or not carriers could write policies effectively to preclude stacking. So it was apparently someone's idea back in 84 that it would be a grand notion to protect Allstate and State Farm and other major carriers from injured Alaskans who might somehow get more than one coverage, even though they may have paid for more than one premium. Someone might have, you know, a $200,000 injury and have paid for two or three uninsured motorist premiums because they had two or three policies or two or three vehicles on their policy. And even though they would still remain undercompensated, this law would protect the insurance industry from having to pay any more than one single limit associated with one single vehicle. Well, since this law was enacted, there's been at least one critical development that I think the committee should be aware of. And that development is a case of Hillman versus Nationwide Insurance Company decided by the Supreme Court of the state of Alaska in July of 1988. Hillman involved facts that arose before the enactment of this legislation, but the court talked about it a bit anyway. And in essence, the Supreme Court said quite clearly and quite unambiguously that insurance companies can, within their policies, if they do so clearly and unambiguously, avoid this stacking problem. In other words, it's okay, our Supreme Court has said, to have anti-stacking language in a policy. And if it's there, our Supreme Court is going to enforce it, just like they did in the Hillman versus Nationwide case. In light of that, I think I would ask this committee to, I think, ask an extremely important question, which is, why do we need 2824-45 or any portion of it now in the state of Alaska? What benefit is this statute or any section of it to the people of the state? Indeed, if there is any benefit here at all, there seems to be a questionable benefit to the insurance industry. Looking at specific portions of Section 3, I guess I'm really concerned about the last sentence that says recovery by the insured is limited to the actual damage incurred by the insured. First of all, that's the law. There's absolutely no case in this jurisdiction or any other that I know of that runs contrary to this idea. And I suppose that begs the question, if that's the case, why does this language worry me? Well, it worries me because currently, if you're a first-party insurance carrier, the insurance company that has written for you, the insured, either uninsured or uninsured or underinsured motorist coverage, if they're caught in an act of what I'm going to generally call bad faith, if they're caught lying, cheating, or stealing from you, you can bring litigation against them, and your client may potentially recover amounts in excess of the policy. Those are extremely important rights. They are virtually the only way by which the industry is limited in its conduct in any meaningful way, at least in my opinion. And I'm really concerned that this language, while offensive in this context, may be argued in the context of bad faith litigation to provide some sort of broad immunity for insurance industry misconduct.
Snyder.
And for that reason, I find it somewhat frightening and somewhat unfortunate. As to Section 4, if anybody wants to interrupt me with the questions I go, that's certainly okay with me, but I'll just keep going unless I hear someone break in. As to Section 4, I guess I've got the same problem. Why do we need any part of Sub B at this point in time? Why? Look at subsection 1, for instance, amounts any recovery for your UM or UIM coverage, and I guess I'd like to point out that these are coverages that Alaskans have paid a premium for, okay? Why should they be limited or reduced by a workman's compensation recovery? An individual receiving workman's compensation, let's say you're driving the truck, you're on the job, somebody hits you in the rear, yes, you can receive workers' compensation, but you may also have a claim against the person that hits you. Well, if you recover from the person that hits you, and I think we can all see the wisdom in that, you've got to pay back the workers' compensation carrier. I mean, here, the industry is in a position to get double-dipped. Your client can't get the UM or UIM that the client has paid a premium for, yet they have to give back all or a significant part of their comp recovery because of subrogation provisions that exist in the law of workers' compensation. And this, again, just seems like a giveaway to the industry to the detriment of Alaskans, and I don't hear anyone coming forward, and nor have I in the last number of years we've dealt with these issues, providing anybody with any quid pro quo. What do we get in exchange for this giveaway to the industry that's in Section 1 here? I guess an even worse provision is B2. Your UM or UIM coverage is reduced by amounts paid or payable under valid and collectible automobile med pay insurance. This is a provision that not only cuts against injured people in Alaska, but this is a provision that gives money directly to the insurance industry and takes it directly from the state of Alaska, and I'm about to explain why, if that seems a little bizarre.
Mr. Snyder.
Yeah.
You understand that the proposal is to take that out of there.
I didn't understand that. If that's
well, that's what the capital,
idea, and I'll stop talking.
That's what the capital letters mean.
Okay, thanks. I guess that applies to sub 3 as well.
Yeah, but right. Number 1 still.
Hey, I'm all for that, too. As to Section 5. Section 5 is really the reason that it was necessary for Representative Donnelly and whoever else introduce this legislation to bring it up to begin with. This is the anti-stacking language. Once again, since the Hillman case, the insurance industry is able to deal with this problem through its policies, as all major carriers do, and now that they know what the law in the state of Alaska is, the Hillman case plus the language in the policy makes 445C superfluous, and really, if anything, it ought to be repealed. However, I think the language imposing liability on excess policies it would be an appropriate addition to the law. Section 6, the same comments apply here. This deals with the 2820 step, of course, that's the Motor Vehicle Safety and Responsibility Act. 2822 deals with other policies, the policies that most of us have, and I've got the same problems. The only reason to have 2822-221 at all was because of ambiguities in the law that existed before the Hillman decision. Now that those are gone, I guess my hope would be that the committee would consider recommending repeal of this section. Because carriers can easily address any stacking problem within their policy, and the Supreme Court has said so in rather clear and unambiguous terms. I would agree that it would be a good addition to the law to add the language exposing excess policies, and I would again be very concerned about the last bit of added language that talks about limiting to actual damages incurred, not because I've got a problem with the idea, but I've got a big problem with the way it might be used in other litigation. And those are the extent of my comments on this bill.
Okay, Mr. Snyder, can we address your concern on Section 3, if we were to add after recovery was limited to actual damages, unless there's bad faith on the part of the insurer?
I like that.
Okay. All right, is there any other questions for the witness? Thank you for your testimony today. I'm trying to see who we have from the division on this subject.
We have Mr.
there's some places that are good hunting for traveling. So how can a guy that's trying to make a living in the woods, basically you gotta hit every resource you can, especially nowadays because they've limited it so much. So that's the reason that I've used it that way.
Okay, and then since you have residence, time spent, degree of income, and you said you put more emphasis on residence and spell out different points for time spent, degree of income, you have in your mind all degrees or numbers that you'd be talking about here, or maybe a 10-point maximum or something?
Well, yeah, I guess I do. And when I say from the resource, I'm talking more in terms of related. In other words, a guide that guides an area in the fall and in the spring, if he fishes in the summer, he's just utilizing another aspect of that same basic circle of resources, or he traps in the winter. So if say, degree of income was, let's just use a figure of $10,000 so that we can break it up really easy. The man puts down $10,000 was made this year. And he says, well, $3,000 of that was made guiding. That's only 30% of his income. Then...
I just got your memo and was trying to read it and listen. And it's like trying to read a case or something very technical. And as a result, I didn't hear very much and I didn't get very much out of this. Maybe you can tell us. It looks to me like you're suggesting two different amendments to the bill here. One is a recommendation, and they both would add additional sections or subsections. If you could just, Mr. Chairman, if I may, just explain to us what the problem is and what your suggestion is and why it works.
Mr. Chairman, my voice is not holding up too well today, and
The two suggestions are on the last two pages.
My name is Don Coates. I'm the acting deputy director with the Division of Insurance. With me is Stan Garlington. I'm using our market conduct section. Mr. Garlington has been working extensively since your last hearing on these issues. And at this point, I'm going to turn over to him and act as a resource to the degree I can.
Chairman Donnelly, Representative Grunberg. Pursuant to Mr. Cope's instructions, I took a look at the issue of subrogation and that portion of the committee substitute dealing with subrogation rights and tried to come up with something that would be reasonably equitable. I came to the conclusion that a proration of the costs of the securing subrogation between insurers and insureds met with what has historically been the equitable nature of subrogation. I found some concern with the language and the manner in which the committee substituted dealt with limitation of subrogation rights. The first one was primarily technical, that being that it seemed more appropriate to put it in Chapter 36 dealing with trade practices and frauds, so it applied to all insurers, whether they're admitted surplus lines or unauthorized. Chapter 42 generally is construed to apply only to admitted insurers, which are insurers for whom the division has prior approval for their the forms and policy forms that they use. Secondly, I was concerned about the concept of what fully compensated for the loss would mean in a practical context. It is often the crux of an issue which goes to a jury as to what the measure of damages is. It becomes especially complicated in a liability situation in which there is comparative negligence on both the plaintiff and defendant. Assuming it's 50-50, then we would have a situation in which the person making the claim would be legally entitled to only 50% of their damages because of the comparative negligence, and the damages would be determined by the jury. Oftentimes, the damages are not finite and measurable. One can normally appraise the damage to a vehicle, but when one is dealing with pain and suffering and other general damages, we're dealing in an area which is best left to juries to decide how much pain and suffering an individual went to. So it seemed to me that there was the potential for extensive litigation over the issue of what being fully compensated for the loss would mean, and it was my impression attending the last hearing that that was not what the committee's desire was. They wanted something that was relatively clean and cut. They didn't want to open up a full employment program for the courts and attorneys.
So what's your suggestion?
So in that basis, looking at prorating the cost of subrogation, the recovery of subrogation, in line with what we had done dealing with physical damage to motor vehicles and property damage in the unfair claim rates. Basically, both the insurer and the insured would share on a pro rata basis the spoils that would come from an effort at subrogation.
I see that's what your final page here does.
Correct.
And that would be in place of section one of the bill?
Correct.
Now, on the last page of your memo, which is the previous page, you're suggesting that there would be another amendment, Mr. Garland, and if you could tell us what that does.
In reviewing the material that I received from Mr. Koch, there was a lot of discussion of the relationship between medical payments coverage and uninsured motorist coverage. And it seemed equitable that it be crystal clear in this legislation that an injured person gets to collect on their medical bills once, not once under medical payments coverage and not once under uninsured motorist coverage. And secondly, that in the unfortunate situation in which the injury is so horrendous that the medical bills would be paid under medical payments coverage plus the full amount of the uninsured motorist coverage available wasn't sufficient to fully compensate the individual, that the uninsured motorist coverage would be fully available in addition to the medical bills paid under the medical payments coverage.
So you would suggest that as an additional amendment then?
I have recommended that to Mr. Koch, yes.
Okay. I don't have any more questions of these witnesses. I'm wondering if Mr. Frank had a chance to review this language too.
Mr. Frank?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Groomberg, I have...
Mr. Frank, could you go ahead and sit at the table?
Sure. Thank you. I have not reviewed the language on the Medicaid section. I can't comment on that, but I did have an opportunity. As a matter of fact, I was with Mr. Garlington this morning when he drafted the substitute for Section 1, and we can that's an amendment we can live with.
I think they're wrong. I think it's going to be the way it's in the bill.
But I mean, depends on what you want to do. Well, Mr. Snyder, I don't think he has a copy of this because we were just delivered this. So, Mr. Snyder, you don't have a copy in Anchorage of the things we're working on because it was just delivered to us, this proposal of a substitute for a prorated subrogation clause for Section 1. But I know you oppose it, so just hang in there.
Mr. Chairman, I'm inclined to think that what you're suggesting is fair, but I haven't heard the other argument against this. It seems to me that if both parties have a share in the outcome, it's fair that both bear their pro rata share of the costs. Well, I don't know the opposite argument.
Okay, the opposite argument is that you're deducting the cost of retaining counsel or your expenses for pursuing your damages from the amount that otherwise would make the person whole. So the person never gets made whole under this pro rata formula because they're going to have to expend money to do so.
I understand that, but on the other hand, under Rule 82, attorney's fees, the policy is specifically not to allow full recovery for your attorney's fees. So I'm not aware, unless it's simply vexatious litigation, any case where the court even awards full attorney's fees. So even if you're completely without fault injured plaintiff, you still have to bear part of your costs in the typical case. So it seems to me that this is a fair result, but somebody can correct me.
See, that's the point, though. I mean, if you're insured, you should be buying protection to make yourself whole, not partially whole, or whole less your attorney's fees are the difference between Rule 82 and your damages. You know? That's the whole point. But, I mean, obviously the industry would rather have it segregated, and the victims would rather have their selves made totally whole by being compensated for the cost it meant to pursue the damages. You know, it's just a policy call. Well, I've got one more question, then I want to do something one way or the other on this, and that's on the final recommendation that you ran through with Representative Colvin. The new Section C to be added to 28.2445.
Yes, sir.
Can you tell me again why you think that's necessary?
So that it's... I guess, way back up a second. One of the things that I try to do in terms of reviewing policy forms that are submitted to the division for our approval is to make sure that insurers aren't heading themselves off to court with sloppy language and leaving certain items vague so they become matters of dispute. So the language in the policy does cover exactly what the insurer's intent is in terms of coverage. In that line, what I sought to do was to make crystal clear the relationship between medical payments coverage and the uninsured motorist coverage, which was an item that was silent in the bill as it existed. Whether the medical bills would be paid under the medical payments coverage, under the uninsured motorist coverage, or under both. And I felt it best to avoid misconceptions or unnecessary assumptions to make it crystal clear that amounts that were payable under the uninsured motorists or uninsured motorist coverage would not pay in the amounts paid or payable under valid or collective automobile medical payment coverage. As a result, it would be real clear that medical bills would be paid once, and it would resolve that problem.
Well, doesn't the section of the bill that says that, I mean, the recovery was limited to actual damages, doesn't that cover that?
I haven't been involved in that particular portion, but I'm not sure what the committee intended in terms of actual damages. If one is talking about damages that have been paid to date, medical bills, or being compensated for loss of wages that have been incurred as of the date of settlement, we're dealing with actual wages. If we're dealing with future medical bills, if we're dealing with future lost wages, if we're dealing with the pain and suffering that an individual is going to have throughout the rest of their life, I'm not sure whether that would meet what a court would construe as being actual damages.
So I think a better way of getting at what you want is just to have a definition of actual damages.
I'm not sure what the committee intended. I'm just saying that it's open to various interpretations, and I don't think that's what the committee intended.
Representative Gruber?
I see some potential. Our drafters usually draft things in their own style, and very few people who are not former drafters or present drafters can completely understand it. I understand what you're trying to do here, and I think it may be equally or more appropriate to do it the way the chairman has suggested, but treating this thing as a conceptual amendment, I understand what he's trying to do, and it's very clear.
Yeah.
How do you wish to proceed, Mr. Chairman?
Well, as much as I don't like it, I think we're probably going to have to adopt the first proposed amendment to the committee substitute, and then I think
I will move that we adopt this amendment to section 21.36, subrogation recoveries, and I would ask that certainly our bill drafters are going to have to put it in the normal form, and to that extent it be treated as a conceptual amendment. And if we're going to move the bill out today, possibly staff can show it to us before it's going across tomorrow on the floor, so we don't have to hold it for another day. So I would move that amendment with that caveat.
Okay. Without objection? Okay. That amendment's adopted into the committee substitute. Representative Gruber?
I know very little more about this area now than when we started out. It seems to me that this other amendment that Mr. Garlington has suggested sounds non-controversial.
I think it's controversial. I don't think it's needed.
Oh. Okay. Well, then. I would ask that I'm not going to offer it, but I'd like you to talk at some point with Mr. Hemingway, because this goes to my committee next, and I'd like to learn more about it and why you think it's needed, unless you want to have more dialogue today on the subject.
Okay. We have a substitute as amended before us. The next stop is judiciary. What do you think?
Mr. Chairman, I don't see any burning need to do any of the other amendments. I understand the spirit in which they're offered, and I appreciate it. There is one other thing. Mr. Schneider suggested that Section 3 be amended to contain language unless there's bad faith.
Yeah.
And either the chairman, okay.
Unless there's bad faith on the part of the insurer.
Why don't we just, so for the record, Mr. Chairman, indicate where the amendment will go, and if you want me to.
Okay, that'd be page 2, line 6, after the word insured, and add the words, unless there is bad faith on the part of the insured.
Okay, so the amendment is, unless there's bad faith on the part of the insurer, on line 6, after insured, and also I'll move the amendment.
Okay. Objection? And objection, motion carries. The other suggestion Mr. Snyder went was to, instead of deleting sections 2 and 3, of Section 4 to just delete all of that Section B.
I am not moving that. But I'm not foreclosing it in the next committee of referral. I really want staff to look at that. This is so technical an area. I'm very loath to do anything unless we really know.
Okay. All right. Well, then we have the committee substitute before us as amended.
Just one final question to Mr. Frank. You ran through a number of things a few minutes ago. Is there any other burning issue you wish to have us consider? I just want to be real sure.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gruenberg, not that we haven't already. No other issue, Representative Gruenberg, that we haven't already discussed at some point, either this week or last week.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So, Representative Gruenberg, would you make a motion to make the vote?
I move that all the amendments be rolled into a new committee substitute.
Okay. My objection.
I move the new committee substitute with individual recommendations, with the understanding that we'll have copies in our box.
Well, we'll be
left
with when we get it from the drafters.
When we get it from the drafters, okay. So we can take a look at it before it's right across.
Okay. Objection, the bill moves on to judiciary. And now we're on House Bill 430. And Mr. Udohosen, you're signed up to testify?
Yes.
Please proceed.
Chairman, thank you.
My name is James Udelhoven. I'm the president of Udelhoven Oil Field Services. And mainly today, I would like to, on the record, get clarification on the bill. Number one, is my understanding, Mr. Chairman, the double time has been dropped. Is that so?
Mr. Udelhoven, there's a report, committee substitute before the committee hasn't been adopted yet, that doesn't have the double time provision that was in the original filed bill in it. That's right. Yeah.
All right.
Okay, then my next question, Mr. Chairman, is as to the clarification of the new language as we go from the fifth day into the time and a half provisions of the sixth and seventh day. When we get to the eighth day, do we then drop back to straight time? The eighth, ninth, tenth day.
That's correct. It only applies to the sixth and seventh day, consecutive day.
Okay, very good. I have no further discussion on that. Thank you.
And further, any questions for Mr. Udelhoven? Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, there's no agreement.
It would be helpful, at least to me, since we have a lot of people here and a lot of new stuff in this. I'm not sure what's in the new committee substitute. Before we adopt it or take testimony, if somebody can walk us through what the differences are so all of us know what we're dealing with legislatively today on this bill.
Great. There's a proposed committee substitute. It's 279 in the draft that the changes from the prior committee substitute are that we've tightened up the work week provision on the consecutive days to make it clear that the consecutive days only apply when they were of at least 40 hours or more worked in the five consecutive days. There was a question about what if the 5 days somebody worked at McDonald's part-time or something.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I don't know how many people here have the new version here, but it looks to me like we're eliminating that Section 1 no longer is in the new bill. The exemption on 23
guides is amended.
Okay, so that's taken out.
Right. We're trying to deal with that separately. So that there's only three subjects in the bill now. That's the long-haul drivers, the payment of overtime, tighten up the overtime statute to make sure that overtime is paid after 40 hours or over 8 hours a day, 40 hours a week or 8 hours a day. And the providing of a work camp for public works projects on a remote site.
Mr. Chairman, since Mr. Udelhoven and others are very interested in that one section that he just testified about, I think that it's important that if we have extra copies, that you be able those people be able to see what you've got in here. The language says, now, if I may, Mr. Chairman, are we still on teleconference?
Yeah.
Okay. Are there extra copies, or do you have a copy back there?
Ginger can make
them. You don't?
Yeah,
okay.
Definitely.
Okay. The staff will make some. It's at the top of page 2. It says, an employer who employs an employee for at least 40 hours of work in more than 5 consecutive days without a day off shall pay compensation to the employee for the employee's hours of work on the 6th and 7th consecutive days. The rate of 1.5 times the regular rate of compensation. This subsection applies regardless of the number of weeks in which consecutive days are worked by, in which the consecutive days worked by the employee occur. It doesn't specifically say that once you're up after the 6th and 7th day, you go back to straight time. Is that implied, though?
Yeah, based on the work week. I mean, 7-day work week. Okay, so while staff make the more copies of that, we'll just go ahead and proceed to Mr. Reinhardt and Mr. Johnson.
Here at the same time, could we both
sure
step up here?
Yeah, but, yeah.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Reinwald. I'm here today representing Alaska Loggers, and with me is Mr. Clyde Johnson, who's Industrial Relations Manager from Ketchikan Pulp. First of all, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this committee has always been very open to having discussions on complicated issues, and I've got to apologize. We're bringing an issue to the committee belatedly that I frankly did didn't understand fully from reading the bill, and that does deal with the issue of the sixth and seventh day consecutive days of work and how that affects current operations. And after discussing this with staff, Ginger has been very helpful on this issue and discussing, frankly, with Pat Smuts, what the impact would be. I contacted the Public Mills yesterday, so that's the reason Mr. Johnson is here. But again, I apologize for being a little bit late probably raising this issue with you, but we thought that the committee ought to understand the impact, at least of current operations at Ketchikan Pulse, and I believe that APC has the same problems. With your indulgence, I'd like to have Mr. Johnson take it. Thank you.
Yeah, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, representatives. Thank you for letting me speak here today. I'm Clyde Johnson. I'm the Industrial Relations Manager at Ketchikan Pulp Company, and we have approximately 950 employees. Not all of the employees that we have would be impacted by this measure, and I want to apologize. I did not get the new, even a look at the substitute, so the remarks that I'm going to make.
Ginger, can you give a copy? Can you give a copy?
May or may not apply to what you currently have before you.
I guess you're specifically concerned with the work week, how the work week's established, right?
Yes, I'd like to explain to you.
On the top of page 2 is the language in the proposed committee substitute.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to give to you, and I have to tell you that this came out of an argument for an arbitration case, but the reason I'm giving it to you is that it describes the current practice at Ketchikan Pulp Company and probably a great many other pulp mills or some, I believe that Sitka has a very similar schedule. I want to tell you that most pulp mills, and certainly Ketchikan Pulp Company, in its operation that runs 24 hours a day, has to cover all those hours. And the way that that is done is that the crews that do that, you have 4 crews, and on any given day, 3 of those crews are working, and 1 of those crews would be on their day off. And so we get the 24-hour coverage. In this particular case, if you would follow on what is called A shift, we have A shift, B, C, and D shift. A shift, for instance, if you would know, we could come to work on the graveyard shift beginning on a Wednesday. They work 7 consecutive days, and if you will note where it says day off on the bottom, you'll note that A shift then has in the following week Wednesday and Thursday off, and then comes to work on Friday on swing shift, works 7 consecutive days, has Friday off in the following week, and then begins Saturday on day shift and works 7 consecutive days, and then has what is termed long weekend, and that they have Saturday, Sunday, and if you go back to the first part, they again have Monday and Tuesday off, which completes their 28-day cycle. Each of the other shifts that you can see, you can follow their schedules through this. The work week is set. It is a practice that has been in effect for about 36 years. It is not the original schedule that Ketchikan Pulp Company had. When the mill started, there was another schedule which was lost in antiquity someplace. That particular schedule was not liked by the employees, and a couple of employees had come from another pulp mill and said, listen, we have a better idea of how to schedule this so that we can cover the shifts, and it would be better for us, and the mill said, well, we don't care if this would work out better for us, we'll do that. And so essentially we've had this schedule for nearly 36 years. It has been changed at one time in that we were told that our shift rotation was in the wrong direction, that it was against a biological clock, and so we negotiated with the unions. We told them that we wanted to go in the other direction from this, and after negotiating with them, we did that. Contrary to what the scientists say, the people didn't like it, and we soon, upon the employees and the union's request, we went back to this schedule and been with it since. And the work week is set, and is set according to the Alaska law, and which parallels the federal law, in that we have a Monday through Sunday schedule, and it has not changed. It's 168 consecutive hours. It has not changed for the purpose of avoiding overtime. If you will note, this particular shift, when when a person works over 40 hours in the week, that person will receive overtime, and that in this schedule occurs once in a 28-day work cycle. Okay. If anyone has a question on that, I'll come back, or I can come back to it if you wish, however you wish to proceed, Mr. Chairman Donnelly.
Okay. Questions for the witness? Representative Lehman?
Mr. Chairman, my question is, I'm trying to understand the state's wage and hour law and how that meshes with federal wage and hour law. It's my understanding, sir, that this is consistent with existing federal wage and hour law. I would assume it would be if it's been in place for 36 years. And I just have one other comment. That I, at one time, worked on a 24-hour, one of these operations that was ongoing, and there were four people to cover three positions, and I don't recall if it was organized exactly the same way, but it's similar to this. And it's my understanding that this is a fair division of the days, and under this procedure, certainly under mine, there was no overtime that was provided at that time. And I just wanted to check to see if it's your intent on a situation like this, that would be covered under this bill if it was inadvertently included in the bill and did not intend this.
The bill was intended to prevent this practice.
Well, then, Mr. Chairman, my comment, thank you, sir. My comment is that this is exactly the type of thing that I would object to the bill, then, at least that portion of the bill, because this is the type of thing that where we try to work, or a business tries to work with labor to work out schedules that accommodate production and accommodate people, and this, you know, this is the type of arrangement. I would think they probably could arrange it with more broken up schedules, but this is the type of thing to accommodate people's desire for longer times off and things like that. It would be appropriate to leave it in a situation like this.
Are there any questions for
the
Representative Grimmer?
I'm probably at the opposite end of the spectrum from Mr. Lehman, because I've never worked on a schedule like this, and this is very interesting to me. As I understand it, it results with people ultimately having 4 days off in a row.
That's correct. That's called a long weekend, and people like to go fishing or hunting or take a plane to Seattle or come to Juneau or whatever, to Eagle Crest during that period of time. It allows them both extra time to do that, and not being restricted to 2 days off.
And if people are, do they get annual leave to so many days vacation a year and this sort of thing?
Yes.
And that's taken care of within your individual section, A, B, C, or D?
When a person goes on vacation or has other days off, people will be relieved for that period of time, and they don't.
And this works 365 days a year, Christmas, New Year's, and everything?
That's correct. It works except when we have our maintenance shutdowns. We shut down a couple of times a year, in order to rehabilitate the plant for all of its frailties.
And just one more question, Mr. Chairman. I gather that people would be working in a two-week period. They would work six. They could work 6 days on, 1 day off, and then six more days on.
They would work.
So in a period of 13 days, they'd only possibly get 1 day off.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Donnelly and committee members, I have some other remarks on that. I think it may be of interest to you if I would hand you a document that is an arbitrator's opinion that goes deeply into this subject, and it talks about the laws and so forth. When I handed you this, someone seemed to indicate what they wanted to know what it was for. In this particular case, this was prepared for this arbitration case. In preparation for the case, this was drawn, sent to the state, and said, does this meet the standards of the state? And the state said yes. I hope I have enough copies here. It will light my briefcase up if you want.
Under new legislation, you may have to print this on both sides.
Well, I'd like to make a couple of other comments about at least what the original bill was, with the operation that had 12 or less employees. Logs could be gotten out of the woods, and this wouldn't apply. But when those logs went for manufacture, which you know I would think would be a desirable thing in the state to manufacture, those logs got to the manufacturer, then he would have the increased cost of this bill, and I don't think that that would promote the commercial aspects of the state. We also find ourselves, as always, with a product that is made in other mills located in other states, and mills made in other countries. I don't think too many people understand what our product is. It's not the stuff that you make this out of. It's a product for making rayon. We have a new mill that's going online in the Pacific. We, of course, have our competition in Canada. But what I would like to point out, as far as the little research that I could put into this in the time that I've had it, I think that Alaska would be a standalone state on this. I know of no other state in the United States that has this provision. And that being so, I'd point out that it would be harder for companies to justify operations in Alaska. Also, I'd like to point out that this has been the subject of collective bargaining through a 36-year history. The NLRB in law mandates that we negotiate over this, and in fact, we did some negotiation over this. We have three units in our pulp mill. We have other units, but three in our pulp mill where this particular schedule applies. The IBEW, which we have about 18 employees. We have the IUOE, ably represented by Mr. Johnson back here, which has about 43 to 45 employees, and the pulp workers. And this schedule has been negotiated and talked about at different times during the terms of those agreements, and is always available to be talked about when that process is over. We've just concluded two bargainings with the two of the units, and received three-year contracts. It would seem unfair now that we have considered our labor costs and projected those labor costs, and then have them increased, not through the collective bargaining process, but by some legislative process.
Okay, Representative Finkelstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I must apologize because I missed the beginning of your testimony, and you might have already covered this. But in the sheet that I find real helpful, laying out a work week, it seems that you could take the same number of days and work them out to, you know, work a 5-2 kind of schedule, 5 days on, 2 days off. So I probably missed what the objection is to doing that.
Chairman Donnelly and Representative Finkelstein. A lot of people have played with this schedule over a number of years in operating a 24-hour operation. And this is the one that is best liked by our employees. If you do lay that out where we have 5 and 2, you will note that some of the people that are providing the labor for the 2 are bouncing around quite a bit. In this case, everyone is treated equally. They have the same schedule, and it's one that we've had a long history of, as one in many of the mills in the United States.
So, Mr. Chairman, basically, your objection to going that is too that you've got collective bargaining agreements in place that would be precluded by this measure, and two, that it's supposed to be employee preference.
It is employee preference, and yes, we do have bargaining agreements in place. We do not have a bargaining agreement with the third unit, however, this was satisfactory to them. It was not on their agenda and is not on their agenda for changing.
Thank you.
How did this arbitration case arise? It seems like it was an issue for somebody out there.
Yes, the issue arose prior to the expiration of the previous contract. The contract was being renegotiated, or the arbitration case was actually started prior to the renegotiation. During the negotiations, the union that was involved said that they wanted this on their agenda, and when it was pointed out that it was inconsistent with their feeling that they already had that, they withdrew. We didn't hear about it again, but the arbitration case proceeded, and I think this date on this is January 21st of this year. Takes a while to get those things through.
Okay. Further questions, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Johnson, I'm somewhat familiar with other similar dissolving grade mills in the Northwest and other mills. So to your best of your knowledge, I assume you talked with them, either those also owned by Louisiana Pacific and those owned by some of your competitors. To your knowledge, do the other mills use similar schedules, these 7-day rotating schedules that are very comparable to what you use here, and in so doing, pay straight time, with the exception of that one day that falls in that odd day?
That's correct. Maybe I should clarify that and say, except in cases where it's been changed by collective bargaining agreement. There may be cases where collective bargaining agreements may require more overtime as a result of those agreements.
Further questions? Thanks for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnson, Jim Johnson.
Chairman Donnelly, it occurs to me that I want to testify on the remote camp board and room thing and not this work hours thing. Perhaps you want to continue on that before you get into this other issue.
Okay. We'll come back to you now. Who would like to testify on this particular issue? Beverly Ward?